We've all probably heard of the term buyer beware. It means to watch your back if you buy something. It means you can't assume that you're going to get what you really wanted because someone will likely try to take advantage. I think one place that's especially true is if you go on the internet. Those of you with your computers surely understand what I'm saying. Every time I go on the internet, I take a certain amount of risk. I have one program that guards against viruses that would come in and try to upset my computer in one way or another. I have two more programs that clean out the junk the virus program misses, the adware, the spyware that manages to be inserted into my computer system. Derek's computer has one more program than I have because some of the websites that he tends to go to, quite frankly, have a little more incentive to put some junk on the computer than maybe the news groups that I would read from myself. I cleaned up, scanned the computer, looked for everything, cleaned it all up on January the 25th. And I didn't scan it again till this last Thursday. That's a little deficient, but anyway, I didn't scan it again till Thursday. There were 27 new objects resident on my computer that were not there on the 25th the month before. And so I ran the programs and I cleaned them all out. Some of them were data miners. They save the information of what I'm doing on the computer so it can communicate with another computer on the internet. And some of what that does is it tells what websites you go to and what things you look up on those websites, because they want to send you an advertisement that will match what it is that you're interested in. So when your computer communicates with another computer on the internet, they're talking to each other, and your computer is giving up secrets. It's telling the other computer what it is that you do. Now that's kind of an amazing process. So it's really a buyer beware. When you go on the system, you have to know that it's communicating in some ways that, quite frankly, you would prefer that it didn't. We've had to take Derek's computer to a computer store twice to get it cleaned up enough to where we could then continue to try to maintain it from that point forward. You could tell your computer not to talk to anyone. You can set your computer up and say, "Don't you say a word." But what happens then is basically you cannot go on the internet because the internet is a communication form from one computer to another. And frankly, you cannot even go on Microsoft's website. I use MSN. You cannot even go on Microsoft's website without reducing your security settings because they require it. If you're going to come to me and look at what we have, then you're going to have to let me look at you as well. And that's how the computer is set up. I noticed in the paper this morning there was an article about a program that a lady had signed up with her business that would bring advertising customers that would look at the advertising for her website and bring them into her site, and then she would pay them for how many people came in and connected to her site. And so the company that had set this up and sold her the program apparently had also set up somebody to go out there and connect to her site every so often. Of course, they had to pay the company for the person connecting to the site. Again, it's buyer beware. Every morning you get up, you put on your suit of armor, and when you put it on, you know that there's somebody out there already working on a bigger bullet. That's how our daily program sometimes goes. In the paper yesterday, there was an announcement that Prince Charles is getting married. One day, Prince Charles will be the King of England, and he will be the Supreme Governor of the Church of England, and he has scheduled a civil ceremony for the marriage that is coming. The reason is it is commonly known, it's understood, that he has maintained a long-running affair with his bride-to-be, which included when she was married and had two children, and it included when he was married as well. And so his ceremony is going to be a civil ceremony instead of, in that sense, before the Church of England. You know, things like that, after a time, if you process them all, could tend to make you a little bit cynical. You could begin to expect the worst. What happens, though, if you get cynical? If you begin to question people's motives, if you begin to doubt their sincerity? What happens if we begin to expect to be disappointed, to expect less than more? What does that do to our mind? Look at Proverbs 13 and verse number 12. Hope deferred makes the heart sick. Now, there's a lot of process. I mean, you could look at this in different ways, and it would apply to different things. But hope deferred makes the heart sick. If you really don't have hope or positive expectations, or if what you think is good is not really in reach, it's always out there on the horizon somewhere, says that makes the heart sick. Does not make you well, but when desire comes, it is a tree of life. The Tanakh records that very closely, but it just says, hope deferred sickens the heart, but desire realized is a tree of life. Cynicism, or becoming cynical and negative in our perspective, means that we really don't expect to have desire realized in the people that we have dealings with. It has to do much about individuals and relationships. When we're rock climbing at Challenger Camp, we don't let any of the, we don't allow the campers to say, I'll try. Because I'll try really isn't good enough. It's kind of a, well, if he maybe, I'm not sure I can, we'll see what happens. It's not really a positive assessment of their intent to climb and accomplish a task. So we don't allow them to say that. They can say, look, I'm going to do this. Or they can say, I'll give that everything I've got. They can say something, but they can't say, well, we'll see. Because we'll see means, well, I'm not really committed to making it over the top. Proverbs 17 is close here. I've used it in other contexts, but it is easy to turn, and I think it's an important illustration. Proverbs 17, verse 22. A merry heart does good like medicine, but a broken spirit dries the bones. If we become cynical, and we begin to have a negative perspective in terms of our expectation of those around us, would that be a merry heart, or would that be a broken spirit, to be cynical? It's easy to do. We can look at being cynical in terms of its impact on ourselves, but it also affects our relationships. It affects the way that we treat and look at others around us as well. I read an article this week which really struck me, and I set it aside, and then I picked it back up and I read it again. I want to share it with you. It's by a Dr. Michael Collins, who did his residency at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, probably 20 years or more ago, going back. But he's an orthopedic surgeon. And he describes working with a particular individual and what happened and then the way he began to treat that individual as a result. And I think it's instructive for us. He says, we rebuilt knees and realigned bones and made patients whole again. My wife, Patty, knew that I'd chosen surgery because I wanted to help people. He said, but sometimes my cases ended up teaching me things I didn't expect. Jason Withers was a 36-year-old carpenter who had cut off all four fingers on his right hand with a circular saw. Brings him into the emergency room. He was my first patient in my second year of training. You got to help me, Doc, he begged me in the ER. I have to be able to work. Like me, he was married with young kids. Like me, he worked with his hands. Is there something you guys can do, he asked as his eyes teared up. Can you put my fingers back on? Four fingers taken off with a saw. His co-workers had had enough sense to retrieve the amputated fingers and put them on ice in a plastic bag. The laceration seemed fairly sharp. They looked good except for the index finger. Most of its skin and soft tissue were gone. Still, it was a tall order, reattaching all four fingers. I gave Jason morphine, cultured his wounds, and started antibiotics, and then I sent him for x-rays. He seemed like a good candidate for reattachment of his fingers, or what's called a replant. He was young, and his occupation demanded the use of his dominant hand. There was another factor to consider, though. I said, you don't smoke, do you, Jason? He says, yes, I do. I smoked a pack and a half a day. I said, that complicates things. Dr. Matt Wilk, one of Mayo's premier hand surgeons, hates doing replants on smokers. The failure rate was markedly high, much higher than the non-smokers. He said, I'm not going to stay up all night replanting some guy's hand if he's going to turn around and wreck it all by smoking. But then Jason was pleading, help me, doc. I was so upset about Jason's fingers that I would have given him one of my own. I decided to take a leap of faith conditionally. You have to give up smoking, I told him. First, it's about the worst thing a man can do to his body, but second, it constricts the blood vessels. Assuming that we're even able to reattach your fingers and get adequate blood flow to them, all that work would be down the drain even if you smoked one cigarette. The vessels would constrict and the fingers would die. Sitting there in the ER looking at me, Jason dug a pack of cigarettes out of his shirt pocket, threw them on the floor, and he said, Doc, if you guys put my fingers back on, I'll never smoke again, ever. And I believed him. I called Dr. Wilk and laid out Jason's scenario, working hard to convince him that we should do the surgery. Jason says he'll quit smoking, and he says he'll never take another puff. That's what they all say, the doctor replied, and there was silence on the line. I couldn't stand it any longer. He's a carpenter, Dr. Wilk. It's his dominant hand. He has two little kids. Still no response. Why was he so hard-nosed? Finally, he said, so you think we should go ahead with the replant? And I said, yes, sir. And you believe the guy when he says he won't smoke? He says, yes, sir, I do. He says, okay. Call the OR and let me know when they're ready. Like all replant procedures, the surgery took forever. The two of us, microsurgical tools in our hands, were hunched over the operating microscope for 6 hours. Jason's index finger was too damaged to replant, but we were able to save the others, reattaching the small digital vessels and nerves to each finger and repairing the tendons. For the first 3 days it was touch and go, Jason's fingers looked dark and dusky. Twice a day I went to the hospital room, unwrapped the gauze, and checked. On the fourth day, though, the fingers looked a little pinker, a little healthier. On the fifth day, there was no doubt. The replants were working. Jason and his wife were thrilled. Even to their untrained eyes, there was a difference. On the 10th day after surgery, Jason went home. We had arranged for outpatient therapy and planned to see him in the office in a week. The day after he was discharged, I got a frantic call from his wife. Something happened, she said. The fingers look awful. You have to check him right away. So I told her to bring Jason straight to the emergency room. I was waiting when they arrived. Jason's wife was right. The fingers were cold and almost black. I felt sick. I said, Jason, I am so sorry. He didn't respond. He just stared at the ground. His mouth was set in a grim line. And then a thought occurred to me. It couldn't be. He wouldn't have been that big of an idiot. Jason, I almost whispered, you didn't smoke, did you? He wouldn't answer. I winced and shook my head. Oh, Jason, I said. We all knew what this meant. The more I thought about it, the faster my disappointment turned to anger. What kind of self-destructive fool was he? Hadn't I warned him 50 times not to even take one puff? All the hours of work, the thousands of dollars expended, I dreaded to make the call to Dr. Wilk. We brought Jason back to the OR 3 times over the next 10 days. All we were able to do was whittle away the dead tissue until only the stumps remained. Dr. Wilk never said much. I kept waiting for the hammer to fall for him to tell me what a fool I'd been, how I'd wasted his time. I continued treating Jason, but I was seething, changing his dressings in a cold fury. I went to bat for you, my attitude said, and you betrayed me. Finally, Dr. Wilk took me aside. Here it comes, I thought, the chewing out job of the century. Mikey said, how many fingers do you have on your right hand? Puzzled, I replied, 4. Well, 5 with my thumb. How many fingers are on Jason's right hand? He said, well, none, just the thumb. Then why don't you quit acting like you're the victim? Get off your high horse, start acting like a doctor instead of a judge. So the guy did a stupid thing. But your surgeons have obligations only to smart patients. Give him a break. He's got to live it with the rest of his life. He has suffered enough. I was stunned, lost. It took me a while to realize that Dr. Wilk was saying a human being needed our help, not our judgment. The next time I saw Jason, I apologized to him for not being more understanding. He didn't reply at first. He said, I know it doesn't matter now. I know I'm a cripple for life. His jaw said, he gave me a fierce, determined look. I'm quitting smoking. I'll never have another cigarette. We would start occupational therapy. We'd arrange for vocational rehab. It was too late to get his hand back, but we could help him get a life. Jason, I said, that's a good first step. I wondered if all the truths I'd learned in medicine would be as tough as this. You know, I read that and put it down and picked it up and put it down, and I thought that was a pretty remarkable statement. It is so easy to say, how big a fool could you be? You have destroyed your life and others with you. But at the same time, as the doctor, the older doctor told him, are we only doctors to smart patients? Do we not try to help everyone we can? What happens when you or I run out of sympathy or empathy or compassion? How many times has God had compassion on us? Imagine going to God in prayer, making some kind of request to God and asking God then, well, do I deserve this? What is it that we can ask God for that we could say that we deserve it anyway? How much has He given us indeed that we do not deserve? Is He only a God to the well, or is He not a God to those who are sinners that He calls into His presence? Good Christ in Matthew chapter 9. Look at His approach in verse 35 here. Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every sickness and every disease among the people. It doesn't say He healed every single person everywhere. There wouldn't have been anybody to heal tomorrow. It just said He healed all different sicknesses and diseases. Whatever there was, He could heal it. And He interceded on behalf there of many. But when He saw the multitudes, He was moved with compassion for them, because they were weary and scattered like sheep having no shepherd. Then He said to His disciples, the harvest truly is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore pray the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers unto His harvest. Because it said, because He had compassion for the people that were there. Pray for more laborers, so that there might be more people to serve those who have need of assistance. Sinners, people on whom there is indeed need for compassion and empathy. Matthew 23, verse number 37. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, Christ again speaking, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. So He starts out by saying what her sins were and the damage that had been done and the spite and the anger and the violence that had been perpetrated out of this city for these people. And then He says, how often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you are not willing. He says, how often I wanted to have compassion on you, and I sent you my servants, and you killed them. And I wanted to take you up and hold you in my arms. I wanted you to change. I wanted to help you, but you refused. Now, He could have said, so I killed you all. Or so I'll never help you again. You don't bother coming to me. What kind of fools are you? And He didn't say that. There were obviously people that Christ held accountable. And there were people that He looked to the future in terms of the opportunity they would have one day. But overall, God's whole purpose is to save mankind, not to destroy them. Mankind was created for potential, not for some kind of destructive plaything. Galatians 5. If you look at the fruit of the Spirit, just notice the direction here, the focus, what's where this is put. Fruit of the Spirit is love and joy and peace and being willing to suffer long suffering, then to endure and continue to suffer if need be, but still in the context of love, joy, and peace. Not with your teeth clenched and your fist in a ball, and kindness and goodness and faithfulness and gentleness and self-control. You know, Stephen, when he was martyred, when he was murdered, he asked God to forgive those who were killing him. I'll be amazed at that strength of relationship that he maintained to God with the measure of the Holy Spirit that he had accessed, I guess, as long as I'm alive in this flesh. They were murdering him and he was praying for them. That's what Christ did. Of course, Christ is God in the flesh, but this is Stephen accessing the Holy Spirit. You know, becoming cynical, which is easy to do, but it's poisonous. There's a joke that they told us when we went to school. If I remember right, it was probably in the Army when we were airborne, and maybe it came out since then, and I've superimposed it in my mind, but it seems like it goes back a long ways, which means you've probably heard it 36 times, but not too many of you were in airborne. Maybe you missed it. This person's rather cynical, but he wants to jump out of a plane, and they're showing him what to do with the parachutes. And when you jump out, you pull this chute, your main chute, and it'll blossom up above you and it'll hold you. But if it tangles or something happens, then you pull the chute that's in front. That's your reserve. So if you need to, you pull your reserve chute. Now, that'll come up and it'll hold you. You'll come down a little faster, but you'll be all right. Don't worry about it. But now, if for some reason that twists and hangs up, don't worry. We'll have a truck pick you up at the bottom. So the guy says, all right. So he jumps out of the plane and he pulls the ripcord on the main chute and it goes up and it gets tangled and he's still dropping like a rock. And he says, boy, I tell you, just my luck, you know. So he rips out the reserve chute and it goes up and tangles with the main chute. And now he's sailing down like a rock. And, of course, this guy's a cynic, so he thinks about it and says, you know, just my luck, I bet you the truck won't even be waiting at the bottom. Now, you can say that can't possibly have anything to do with anything, but it does. Hebrews 11, verse number 13. Think of this in terms of perspective. We're all going to die. Now we can die dreading and thinking negatively about our circumstance and lamenting our presence, or we can die in faith, imagining indeed that what God says is true. And the way we look at the finish is going to affect the way we live this life in the flesh. It is going to affect it in a significant way. And we have to strive to hold on to and reach for those positive elements of our faith that affect us in such a significant way. Hebrews 11, verse 13, these all died in faith, not in despair, not in cynicism or negativity, not having received the promises. Their chute didn't open. They died. But they know that there is something and a reason and a purpose for what they have done. But having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, if they had kept their focus just on this present, then they would have had opportunity to return. You want to go there? You can. You want this life? It's here for you. You want to forsake what God promises? You don't have to have it. That's not the point. Verse 16, now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. You know what we're called in the church? Believers. That's what we call believers. These died in the faith, believing in the promises. And so we're called, in that sense, believers, because that's what we believe as well. If you look around the room today, or when you go home tonight, you look over the fence at your neighbors, what do you see? Do you see potential or risk? Is it, boy, look at the opportunity that these individuals have. Look at what they might be able to accomplish in this life. Or do you look at it, wow, there isn't a prayer. Can you imagine what's going to happen when that person grows up and gets on his own? Do you see potential? Do I see it? Or do we see risk? I'm not suggesting that we would be naive, but then let's also not be calloused. Remember, we're believers. That indicates that we focus on potential because ultimately the kingdom of God will be on this earth. But in the meantime, we need to get there and indeed to try to maintain as much as we are able by God's lead a positive attitude and approach. And not become cynical because we see examples of failure or fraud all around us day by day. Matthew 13 is probably the basic chapter, I think, in all the New Testament on parables and addressing why, but the parables are generally about the kingdom of God. And so if you just look at all the parables that are included in this one chapter, then it kind of sends a message in terms of what God thinks our perspective ought to be. If we're thinking in terms of the kingdom, but we're living this life in the flesh, then what should our perspective be? So Matthew 13. In the King James, the New King James, they're all listed real conveniently, so I'll just read the listings. I'm not going to read the parables themselves. First one is the parable of the sower. Parable of the sower would indicate that there's some seed that falls on good ground and some on rocky ground, and some springs up and lasts and some does not, so that there will be indeed a difference in the way others respond to God's call. Next one is goes on and explains that, but it says, then there's the parable of the wheat and the tares. And that says, well, Satan will sow indeed some in our midst who are not called of God, but they're simply here in that sense to trouble us. And they will be with us until Christ returns. They didn't leave 10 years ago or any other time or 5 years ago or three. They're going to be with us until the harvest. But Christ said, don't be worrying about them and trying to get rid of them and rip them out. You're going to cause damage. You just focus on what I gave you to do. So he says, I'll take care of them at the harvest. And it goes on, but notice again, if you look at the weight of the whole message, the parable of the mustard seed, the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, very fruitful, the smallest seed with the biggest possible harvest. Then there's the parable of the leaven, the kingdom of heaven is like leaven. You put it in one lump and it leavens a whole lump. How the kingdom of God spreads and has an impact and bears fruit. Then it says the parable of the hidden treasure. Kingdom of heaven is like hidden treasure in a field, which a man found and hid, and for joy over it he goes and sells all that he has and buys the field. Kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking beautiful pearls, who when he found one pearl of great price went and sold all that he had and bought it. Can you see what's being addressed? It says, sure, there's going to be differences in response. There are going to be problems and troubles, but you need to be positive. You need to look at the value of the treasure and of the pearl, and you need to look at the opportunity that God lays before you. Finally, the parable of the dragnet here, where the kingdom is like a dragnet or a big net cast in the sea and brings in all kinds of things. But you know, God is again the one who makes that sort. It's not for the doctor to say, don't waste our time, you stupid idiot. It's for the doctor to say, as much as he can I help you? What's our problem, our purpose? What were we called to do? To be a judge? You know, the church is not a museum, it's a hospital. If you're going to work in a hospital, then be ready to help. Be willing to help as much as we can. Matthew 13, if you go to the end of the chapter, verse number 53. Now it came to pass when Jesus had finished these parables that he departed from there. And when he came to his own country, he taught them in their synagogues, so that they were astonished and said, "Why? Where did this man get this wisdom and these mighty works? This can't be. He can't do that. I don't believe it. This has got to be some kind of a joke. Is this not the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? His brothers James, Joseph, Simon, Judas? His sisters, are they not all with us? And where then did this man get all these things?" And they were offended by him. And Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor except in his own country and in his own house." Therefore, it says, "And he did not do many mighty works there because of their unbelief." They were not believers. They didn't have the faith and the hope and the positive expectation. Basically, they were cynics. They were negative. They expected someone to try to take advantage of them, and they applied that also to Jesus Christ. They expected the worst, and they got it. They got no miracles, no intervention by God on their behalf. Whereas in another place, Christ healed all the diseases and the sicknesses. Whatever was brought to him, he took care of in that way. When a new person begins to respond to God's call, I think back at the time when God called me. Many of you can think back to the exact same things. What did we have? We had doubts. How am I going to keep the Sabbath and hold my job and get my car ready for my date on Saturday night? How am I going to tithe? Where does that kind of money come from? What is my family going to say when I quit keeping Christmas or Easter and when I no longer associate in that way? What are my friends going to think of me? I'm going to be strange and cast out or separated, put aside. There was a lot of doubts. And so when a person in that sense is weak in their faith, as God first begins to call them, they see the obstacles, they in some ways can have a negative perspective on what God is doing. And they begin to work through that. If they focus more on the obstacles than on the potential, what happens? They go no further. If they focus on the risks instead of their potential, at some point they will stop. Others, those of us hopefully sitting here because we are here, began to take a few small steps and began to trust God, and he began to intercede in our life in some way. We began to be believers, and our belief was strengthened as a result. You know what God says in the book of Malachi? He said, "You know, prove me. You just try me and see if I won't pour out for you a blessing that you can't even contain." And so we say, "Well, here's my blessing. I want it this one, I want it filled this way, and I want it delivered to my front door." I don't think that's what he's saying. But he does say, "You just try me and see if serving me is not indeed a blessing. In fact, I'll bless you beyond what you can even understand." How do we get there? We get there because we become believers, and we become active in our belief, that we do those things that give us hope. We begin to look at others with hope. We begin to encourage and to participate and to share in that way in our calling. James chapter 2, verse number 19. It says, "You believe that there is one God, you do well. But even the demons believe, and tremble. But do you want to know, O foolish man, that faith without works is dead?" In other words, belief isn't enough. In other words, there has to then be some application of that which we understand. "Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered Isaac his son on the altar?" Because he carried through. You don't think he had some doubts? I expect he did. But he went past the doubts and cried out to God and tested God in that way to say, "Okay, I submit myself to you. You're going to have to make this right. Do you see that faith is working together with his works? and that by works faith was made perfect. So our belief is strengthened. We become believers in a stronger way because we do those things that we understand. But if we see the obstacle and stand back, we become negative in our perspective, and we hesitate to go forward, then our belief is not strengthened. Indeed, the demons believe, and that's not enough. They know better, but that's simply not good enough. And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. So what it really means is that he obeyed God according to what he understood, according to what God had called him to do. There was a group of people recently got together in Cuba. They were all 100 years or older. And it was a small group. And they were discussing, you know, what does it take to get to 100 years? Well, in Cuba, you'd have to probably stay out of the penal system, would be part of that program, but what does it take to get to be 100 years old? And so they had different ideas, and I've seen different articles. Every once in a while, somebody does an article on everybody who's 90 or older, everybody's 100 or older, and they ask them what it was that they felt in their life was significant that helped them to live to that age. And in the article, one of the ladies said, well, it's my passion for dancing and singing. And she began to dance and sing for the people there. And another guy said, well, it's hard work and eating vegetables. We'll pray for him. I've read articles in the past, you know, maybe I'm making this up in my mind, but it seems to me at least one of them says having a drink every night that he felt, and one guy said it was having a cigar. I go, oh, come on. But in every one of those articles, in this one specifically, it says they all agreed on one thing, and that was an optimistic outlook was the key. I mean, yeah, they did this and they did that, and some have good genetics and some had something else, but they all basically agreed that having an optimistic outlook was the key to a long and healthy life. Every time I've seen an article, an assessment like that done, that's what they come up with. Being positive in our attitude and approach. Looking at this life in a positive light. Some of those people were slaves in their day. They worked as children in factories in their day. They worked in the fields. They suffered. But they did not buy into a negative attitude and approach. What's the price of being cynical? Well, our health, our friendships and relationships, our peace and contentment, ultimately, if it's carried far enough, our calling. It's a price that's much greater than anything we'd ever want to pay. 2 Corinthians is a passage where Paul is saying in 2 Corinthians 4, he's just saying, you know, we have suffered so much in our service to you. And he talks about how the fact that they struggled and were beaten and had to get back up in that sense and carry on, and how this flesh has taken such a sustained so much damage. But then the flesh is not all that there is. And so the passage here, verse number 7, 2 Corinthians 4, he says, we have this treasure in earthen vessels. We obey God and are called, obviously, in this flesh. But in becoming believers, he puts in us his spirit, and we have this now view and picture of the kingdom of God. That view should impact the way we live in the flesh. It isn't something we wait for the resurrection and then everything's going to begin to finally work. Okay, but we need to have expectation and positive expectation while we live this life now. So we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellence of the power may be of God and not of us. In the flesh, we truly learn to trust God and to rely on Him and not on this flesh. But again, we need to maintain a positive expectation. Verse 16, therefore, he speaks a little bit about their struggles. He says, therefore, we do not lose heart. Wouldn't cynicism and looking at life with a negative lens, you know, you put up your magnifying glass to look at life and your lens is dusky and dark and all of a sudden everything is bleak. And everything you look at has that cast. And Paul said, you know, if you think about it, he's been beaten and whipped and shipwrecked and starved and without sleep and adrift in the water. But he's saying in this case, he says, look, we don't lose heart. We keep our attitude. We strive to look forward to the blessings, not just in the end, but even in God's hand in our life at this time. Even though our outward man is perishing, even though we suffer some in this flesh, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. There is still strength, positive association, and hope. There is still that faithfulness that was mentioned in Hebrews 11, looking forward to and applying in this life those things that are important. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. He says, you know, you don't focus too much on Prince Charles's wedding. And you don't focus too much on the fact that the guy took a smoke, because he will pay for it in his own flesh. We need to make sure that our empathy and compassion never hardens up and freezes, so that we can continue to contribute and produce, and indeed according to the way we have been called in our service. Now, I walked in here today to services. So I left the Moody's. I'm walking out of the door and Paul says, when you get to church, you'll have 4 minutes to spare. Now, what does that tell you? I drove into the parking lot at 6 minutes till, and it took me 2 minutes to walk from the car to the front door. So Paul knows to the minute what it takes to get here. Paul's listening. Paul, that means you will never be late again, right? You know exactly. I'd confirm to you that it works. So I'm watching my watch, bangs, 4 minutes till I walk in the door. Everybody greets me. It's exciting to be here, very pleasant. People in the front are shaking your hand. Wonderful. I mean, you cannot walk in here. I cannot, without feeling that boost and lift. And I walk up the aisle, and Nancy Check was there, and she says, well, you look nice. I said, I cleaned up. She said, no, something specific. I said, well, this is a different talk. She said, well, something, I knew there was something in the combination that was different. You know, same suit, same face, same everything. But this tiny little tie, and I walk in the door and Nancy says, you know, it looks nice. Something about you is different. I thought that was pretty impressive. She obviously wasn't a man. No man would have noticed. Even a little tiny change is enough to make a difference. One thing you do different begins to have an impact. It changes your impression. You just put on a little different color in the tie and somebody looks and says, you know, you look different today. That's nice. We need to put on, even if it be just a little hope and a little joy and a little faith, to change our countenance in a way that will be different and valuable and useful to those around us. Even a little bit will make a difference. We start and go forward from where we are, not from where we used to be, but from here. And we have that within our grasp. And that faith and hope and that joy is not just in that sense in God, but in each other as well. And then see. As God says, it was with tithing, if indeed we would trust Him and believe Him, if He would not pour out a blessing on us that we could hardly believe, then just see if indeed He will not also pour out a blessing on us in that way, and just see if indeed we are not renewed as well. We must be careful to never become cynical in the things that swirl around us, negative in our attitude and approach, to remain positive and hopeful. We are believers, brethren. That means that we believe not just in God, but as He does, we believe in the potential of each other as well. And the more we hold on to that focus, the better servants of God and the stronger our belief is going to be.